In Spain, the manhunt continues for suspects believed to be involved in multiple acts of terrorism this week. On Wednesday, there was an explosion, then a terrible vehicle attack in Barcelona yesterday on that city's historic Las Ramblas Boulevard that killed at least 13 people. Then there was a second vehicle attack today in the city of Cambrils, southwest of Barcelona. NPR's Frank Langfitt joins us from Barcelona. And Frank, first of all, help us understand, how are these three events linked?
Well, you know, as you were saying, Magda, it all began Wednesday night in this coastal city called Alcanar. There was this gas explosion. And first, police thought this was just a domestic accident. And, you know, what you see when you get gas leaks, that sort of thing. Firemen and police came, and then they were injured by a second blast. Well, now what police are saying is that people inside this house were trying to build bombs with gas canisters. And these explosions, I don't know if you've seen the video, the explosions were huge. They leveled the house, killed a couple of people, including one suspected jihadi, and police arrested another jihadi who was injured there at the scene.
And so then after that explosion, did that then just make those folks turn towards, or that group
That's
turn
the
towards,
theory.
Barcelona?
Exactly. That's the theory the police are working under, really, is that this was kind of a botched, it was a mass terror plot to use bombs. And when that fell apart with the explosion, they then sort of had a plan B of sorts. And that plan B we saw play out yesterday. Again, this is just a theory by the cops. It was Thursday afternoon, 5 p.m., as we've been talking about. This man drove a van down the big boulevard here, big pedestrian walkway. There's lots of kiosks and cafes. I'm staying right near here. And usually this time of year, a lot of the year, it's jammed with thousands of tourists. And the van actually covered more than 500 yards before it crashed, and the driver got away. Now, people think who was ever behind the wheel was part of this jihadi group who was building bombs, and they're still actually looking for that person. They're not quite sure who it is. They haven't caught him yet.
Yeah, and I mean, Las Ramblas is one of the iconic streets and boulevards of all of Europe. So that brings us to early today. I mean, tell us more about what happened in Cambrils.
Same kind of thing. As far as the cops can figure, these guys were kind of on the run and also looking to do as much damage as they could in the limited time they probably felt they had left. So five guys were in a car. This is about 3 o'clock in the morning. They come across a roadblock, a police roadblock in the seaside town. It's about 3 a.m. or so. They run the roadblock. They injure some pedestrians. They kill one. Then they roll the car over. Four get out. They attack a cop with knives. He shoots them, kills them, and a fifth attacker stabs a pedestrian. So again, in another part of northeastern Spain, another coastal town, another attack by what police believe are part of a fairly large jihadi cell.
Okay. So Frank, as we mentioned earlier, there is a manhunt still going on. Police are still pursuing people in connection with this. What do we know about some of the suspects?
Well, they're looking, the Catalan police say they're looking for four men right now. One of them is a guy named Musa Okabir. He's a dual citizen from Morocco and Spain. He's either 17 or 18. He's very young. And if you look at pictures of him on social media, he appears like a really skinny young guy. It's kind of quite striking to see him. He lived in a place called Ripoll. It's a town about an hour and a half north of Barcelona, if you're driving. He has no police record. His brother's ID was found in the van that crashed here in Barcelona yesterday, and police have already arrested his brother.
Now, Frank, you mentioned you're not far from where the vehicle attack in Barcelona happened. You've been speaking with people. What are they saying?
Well, you know, it's somber. There are, as you were saying before, this is a huge place where, you know, tons of pedestrians come, and basically you see candles on the walkway. But what's interesting, you know, by afternoon, people were back in action. And some people I talked to said that they kind of expected this, that after certainly the attacks in London, which I've been covering, I've covered three vehicle terror attacks since March, and of course the attacks we've seen the last couple of years in Paris, they're shocked but not surprised by this. Also, remember, Spain has a long history dealing with terrorism attacks, going back certainly to the Basque separatists in the 80s and the 90s. And so I think you get a sense that it's a terrible event, but there is a sense of people kind of getting a little used to it and, you know, knowing that it may be coming. It may be around the corner because we've seen it so much, particularly in the last few months.
Well, you mentioned the UK, so Westminster, London Bridge, and now we have Las Ramblas. These are really striking at the cultural hearts of these cities. Do we know anything more about those at least 13 people who were killed in Barcelona?
Yeah, you know, it was, as you would expect, in Barcelona in August, it was victims from across the globe. And in a sense, we don't know the exact motives of these folks, but obviously terrorists want to get a lot of attention and have that attention spread far and wide. And certainly this was the place to do it. It's 30 people were injured, victims from 34 different countries: Germany, Algeria, Argentina, Australia, China, Romania, Venezuela. One American was killed, another one was injured. And of course, this is a huge tourist city in Europe. It's overrun. There have been a lot of stories in the press recently about how tourism is straining Barcelona. And everybody, of course, who's going to come here, they're going to go down to Las Ramblas. They're going to go down to that pedestrian walkway. It's like going to New York City. You're going to go to Times Square. So it really is a magnet. And obviously, the terrorists knew that this was a good place to do as much damage as they could and get a lot of attention.
NPR's Frank Langfitt speaking to us from Barcelona. Frank, thank you so much.
Well, the attacks in Spain are a huge subject on social media with the hashtags Barcelona and Barcelona Terror Attack and the hashtag No Tengo Miedo, or I Am Not Afraid, a chant Spaniards broke into after a moment of silence earlier today. On Friday, we look at the news through social media. Let's do that now with Femi Okay, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English in D.C. Hi, Femi.
Hello there.
And I should get that right. It's No Tengo Miedo. I am not afraid.
I am not afraid.
It was so chilling when they broke into that.
One of the chants, another one of the chants, we are not afraid. We will not forget. And after a minute of silence that was observed earlier on today, the crowd broke into applause. Now, the Ramblas is a really famous stretch of Barcelona. Mm. It's paved. It's a beautiful area. You hang out to watch people. They watch you. Enjoy the sunshine. Thousands of people were there today. There's a monument right at the top of La Ramblas, and people were taking pictures and leaving candles and leaving flowers. And the mood was defiant. People would break into chants. They would break into applause. I know this because I'm seeing all of this, not on TV, not on websites, but actually on Twitter, online. People are posting their posts from La Ramblas, from Barcelona. So you really get a sense of what they're seeing through their phone cameras.
What else are you seeing on social media about the terror attacks? We're thinking of President Trump has been tweeting today.
There was, and this is a conversation that's been going on for quite a long time about where the US president is in terms of terrorism and terrorist attacks and where he is domestically and then where he is internationally. And there was several comments and lots of commentary talking about how quick he was to condemn what happened in Barcelona and how slow he was to talk about what happened last weekend in Charlottesville.
Well, one tweet from the president today: radical Islamic terrorism must be stopped by whatever means necessary. The courts must give us back our protective rights. Have to be tough. And he's talking there, and that there was a series of tweets about his travel ban and how he believes that Democrats are being obstructionist and making this country safe in light of attack overseas. The other huge story of the week on social media, the president played a part in that as well. The violence in Charlottesville, Virginia, President Trump's press conference, when he said there was blame on both sides and tweeted that it was sad to see the beautiful statues ripped apart. Now, polls show that Americans do approve, over 50% approve of keeping the Confederate-era statues. I shouldn't say Confederate-era because they were put up much, you know, past that era. But we don't do civil rights by polling. Here is the president, you know, talking about how it's their beautiful statues being ripped apart. What's been the response online?
Well, I'm looking at the president's Twitter base. So 32,000 people retweeted that sentiment and 122,000 people liked it. And then underneath that was a conversation really about should we keep these statues, these memories, these monuments, should we put them away in the United States? But I have to say that was a conversation that was being run back and forth online using memes. And this is a beautiful statue. No, this is a beautiful statue. This is a ridiculous statue. Then people sharing their local statues, their Confederate statues, those memories from around the various cities. But I am sitting here on Twitter, not because I'm not paying attention to here and now, but also because I'm looking to see what the latest controversy might be coming from the president's office. And I'm looking, and I just want you to look at hashtag Steve Bannon.
Yes.
We'll wait to the news.
We can actually say that, according to multiple sources, that Steve Bannon is trending because Steve Bannon is fired.
Trending.
He is out at the
hashtag
White House.
Hashtag fire Bannon. Hashtag that has been achieved. So that's happening literally as we're talking. So I know this controversy about the beautiful statues, the Confederate statues, that is going to be by the by for now. And the next 24 hours, I'm sure, is all going to be about Steve Bannon and what he may or may not do now that he is out of the White House.
Several sources saying this is his last day there. We want to know, too, that several tech companies are taking action against white supremacists. Discord, the chat app for video game players, announced it's dropping its altright.com server. So we'll follow that as well. Femi Oke, host of the stream on Al Jazeera English, who's seeing the news happening right in front of her.
As it happens, on tweeting in front of me.
Femi, thank you.
Take care.
And of course, NPR will be reporting all day on the firing, according to multiple sources, of Steve Bannon, President Trump's chief strategist. St. Joseph, Missouri, population 75,000, expecting more than 100,000 visitors for Monday's solar eclipse. Hannah McBride of the digital media organization 60DB has this story of how the city is getting ready for a total eclipse of the heartland.
For Abe Forney, it's less, if you build it, they will come, and more, they are coming, so you better build it.
We're going to have to build a fence starting maybe today.
Forney is the general manager at Rosecrans Airport in St. Joseph, a combined city and military airstrip about an hour north of Kansas City. We're driving around the airport runways to the far side of the property, a large grassy field.
We're almost there.
The fence they're putting up around the field is for eclipse watchers. An estimated 100,000 people are expected to come to St. Joseph to watch the total solar eclipse. It will pass right over the airport tarmac, so officials here are planning to host around 15,000 people on Monday. But Forney says there's a lot of work to do before then.
More porta-potties. We've got a lot more porta-potties coming. We've got some more trash dumpsters showing up. We have trash barrels to put out. Signage. We got a lot of signage and barricades that we have to put up.
Forney gets a text.
So, it sounds like we're going to build fence in 20 minutes.
Astronomer and eclipse chaser Michael Bokic worked with the city to organize the airport viewing party.
I like to think of the eclipse as a pearl. St. Joe is the oyster that's helping that pearl grow. Now, every time you have an oyster, it has to start with a bit of shell or a piece of rock that irritates the oyster. That was my job. And that's really all I did. And the Convention and Visitors Bureau jumped online 3 years ago, and the city, and it's been great.
Bokic says the airport is the perfect place to watch the eclipse because the sky is wide open, and viewers will be able to see totality when the moon completely covers the sun. He'll be broadcasting a play-by-play during the eclipse on local radio stations.
Oh, man. At the airport, when we hear 25,000 people screaming and yelling and crying during totality, man, it's going to be all worth it. Everything I've done for the past 4 years is going to be worth it.
In St. Joseph, totality will last 2 minutes and 38 seconds, just a few seconds shy of the longest totality for this eclipse.
St. Joseph will never host a Super Bowl. This is their Super Bowl.
Back at the airport, I stop by the cafe at Rosecrans. Cheryl Green owns the little 10-table restaurant that serves breakfast and lunch to pilots and the Air National Guard that come over from the base. The windows of her restaurant look right out onto the tarmac. And Green says she'll stay open as long as people come in.
Like most businesses in town, they're going to shut down a half hour ahead of time to about a half hour after. And I think that's what we'll do, and just let the workers and customers step outside and watch it. So, yeah, it's going to be fun.
Forney says the only thing left to consider is the weather.
And I'm going to worry about things that we can control. And I can't control the weather, so I think we'll have good weather. And if we don't wait 5 minutes, it'll change. It's Missouri.
For Here and Now, I'm Hannah McBride.
And on Monday, make memories, not eye damage. Dr. Noom Brandenburg is president of the Georgia Optometric Association. She joins us from the studios of WABE in Atlanta. Dr. Brandenburg, when is it dangerous to look at this event?
Just remember how your mom said, never look at the sun. Mm-hmm. Well, she was right. It is never safe to look directly at the sun, except during that brief 2.5 minutes or so that you have the total phase of a solar eclipse known as totality. Most of us that are not within the path of the totality must always wear the viewing glasses.
We all know what happens when you look up at the sun. Sometimes you get those little dots that eventually go away, the place where it sort of burned under your retina. But what happens with this sharp sunlight that's coming before and after totality? What will that do to your retina?
The little sliver that you see that is not covered by the moon, the radiation coming from that area of the sun can actually burn your retina, and it causes a condition called solar retinopathy, which actually can cause a permanent blind spot in the central part of your vision.
Awful. So let's talk about protection. First of all, we're not talking about even 10 sunglasses on top of each other. We're not talking about 3D glasses you get at the movie. What are we talking about for safe glasses?
We're talking about certified solar viewers, which are thousands of times darker than normal regular sunglasses. And we cannot use 3D viewers that they use in the movies. The proper solar filters are very, very dark. They also block the ultraviolet radiation and the infrared radiation, which can cause the damage to the back of the eyes in a matter of a few seconds. It's also important to note that people should make sure that the glasses are not damaged, because you don't want any part of that radiation coming through.
We're hearing stories about a lot of hoax eclipse watching glasses out on the market there. So you have to check and make sure it has the ISO 12312-2 standard filter. And we'll also link you to a list of safe models from the American Astronomical Society at hearnow.org. Meantime, you know, some of us remember as kids poking a hole in a box. And what is that whole theory?
That's what they call a pinhole projector. You're not actually looking directly at the sun. You're looking at a shadow. There's also other ways that you can use a mirror to reflect the light from the sun onto a flat surface where you can actually see the shape of the eclipse. But it's not directly looking at the sun itself.
Dr. Noom Brandenburg, president of the Georgia Optometric Association, also a practicing optometrist with Kaiser Permanente in Atlanta. Doctor, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And by the way, if you look through a camera or smartphone, you can wreck the camera and your eyes. Okay, best view, though, no clouds, is at 38,000 feet. Now, some commercial airlines are promoting a few regularly scheduled flights in the eclipse path. But Alaska Airlines is chartering a special flight with the best possible eclipse view. NPR's David Schaefer reports.
Shadow coming in.
Oh, yeah, there it is. There's the shadow. Wow, look at that.
This video shows a solar eclipse in March of last year, shot from a window of a Hawaii-bound Alaska Airlines plane. A large, cone-shaped shadow moves over the clouds, racing toward the aircraft.
Oh, my God. We're getting close.
And then the sun goes dark.
Oh, my God, Corona. There it is. Diamond, Barry's Bees. Barry's Bees, diamond ring. Look at that. Corona. Totality. Totality. Oh, my God.
That enthusiastic narrator is eclipse chaser Mike Kentrianakis, who is with the American Astronomical Society.
Look at this. I've never seen it like this, ever. Only in a plane.
Meteorologist Joe Rayo was also on that flight. Rayo says the best land view for that eclipse was in Indonesia. But he also saw that it would pass over the Pacific Ocean about 700 miles north of Hawaii. So he tried to find a commercial airline flight that might be traveling through the eclipse path.
I did with Flight 870, but there was a problem, and the problem was that the flight would arrive at the zone of the eclipse about a half hour too early.
Rayo contacted Alaska Airlines, begging them to delay the departure of that Anchorage to Honolulu flight by 30 minutes and to alter the route just a bit to intercept the eclipse. He says it took 6 months and scores of emails and phone calls, but the airline finally agreed. The flight was such a hit that Alaska Airlines decided to do it again this year with a special flight exclusively to view Monday's eclipse.
So what we're planning to do is to depart from Portland.
Alaska Airlines pilot Brian Holm is the fleet captain who is plotting the course for this special eclipse charter.
And we're planning to fly out to the west a bit, out over the Pacific, and intercept the path of the eclipse out there.
The flight will take off from Portland at 7:45 Monday morning, fly west 1,000 miles, and then turn north towards the path of the moon's shadow.
We know exactly how fast it'll be traveling. It's going to be, at our intercept, it's going to be somewhere on the order of around 4,000 miles per hour. The aircraft will be traveling a little over 500 miles per hour.
Holmes says calculating how to get the plane in exactly the right spot at exactly the right time was a challenge, but he had help from astronomer Glenn Schneider at the University of Arizona. Schneider says it's critical that this flight not just intercept the path of the moon's shadow, but it also has to be positioned just right.
So you need to fly the airplane in a direction where if you're looking out a passenger window, the sun is in the direction you're looking. It's not behind the tail of the airplane or it's not in front of the nose of the airplane.
That means a plane has to fly across the path of the totality of the eclipse, perpendicular to it. And Schneider says there's a reason that flight is going 1,000 miles out over the Pacific Ocean, because it's there that the sun is low enough on the horizon to be almost even with the plane.
It's at a point where the altitude of the sun is at a very comfortable viewing angle so that people looking out of an airplane window, both in the window seat and their partner sitting next to them, can both see the eclipse for about a minute and 45 or a minute and 50 seconds.
Southwest, United, and other airlines are promoting a few of their regularly scheduled flights that will go through the path of the eclipse. But Schneider says for those flights, the sun will be too high in the sky for passengers, even at window seats, to see it. They may get a partial view and a unique look at the full darkness as the moon's shadow moves across the clouds or the ground below. The special Alaska Airlines flight is fully booked. Passengers are all eclipse enthusiasts and astronomers who were invited along, plus two contest winners. But if it's successful, there will likely be more special charter flights for the next solar eclipse. David Shaper, NPR News.
Well, the eclipse is on our watch, and we are ready. We'll be talking to people along the path from Oregon to South Carolina. Author Ron Rash has written a poem of anticipation. We'll hear that. We'll hear what school kids and teachers are doing. NPR's coverage of the Great American Eclipse.
This Here and Now podcast is sponsored by ZipRecruiter, making it quick and easy to find quality candidates. Instantly post your job to over 100 job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with a single click. Plus, get access to over 6 million resumes. Select, screen, and rate candidates with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard and find the right hire fast. Find out why ZipRecruiter has been used by Fortune 100 companies and thousands of small and medium-sized businesses. Get started for free today at ZipRecruiter.com/here.
Chief White House strategist Steve Bannon is out. Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the White House press secretary, said in an afternoon statement today, quote, White House Chief of Staff John F. Kelly and Steve Bannon have mutually agreed today would be Steve's last day. We are grateful for his service and wish him the best, end quote. Well, could others be on their way out the door? Looks like top White House economic advisor Gary Cohn will stay in his job for now, according to a number of news reports. There had been rumors that he might leave earlier this week after the New York Times reported that he was, quote, disgusted and upset by President Trump's reaction to the violence in Charlottesville, Virginia. Michael Regan is senior editor for Bloomberg News, and he joins us now from New York. Hi there, Mike.
Hi, Meghna.
Okay, so Cohn was standing behind the president during that news conference earlier this week when Trump said that there had been blame on both sides for what happened in Charlottesville. Gary Cohn's also Jewish, so tell us more about when the rumors of his possible departure erupted. Markets tumbled. But, I mean, what was going on?
Well, from Wall Street's perspective, Gary Cohn is considered a very positive influence on the president. He's probably the advisor that Wall Street knows the best and was most comfortable with, mainly due to his time at Goldman Sachs, where he had a very public-facing role. He would present at investment conferences and write op-eds and that sort of thing. So investors knew his thinking very well, and they believed he'd be an advocate for business-friendly and frankly, Wall Street-friendly policies. But he's also considered a pragmatist and someone able to make things happen without getting too caught up in controversy.
But how much do we know about Gary Cohn's actual influence on the president? I mean, if Steve Bannon is out today, what does that mean for someone like Cohn?
Well, you know, there were reports of friction between Bannon and Cohn. But part of, I think, the reaction on Wall Street yesterday was the worry that if Cohn did leave, that Bannon would take on a bigger influence on the president. And remember, Bannon was out this week in an interview with the American Prospect, strongly advocating for a trade war with China. And that's obviously something that's going to make investors very nervous. It's interesting today when the news started trickling out that Bannon was going to leave the White House, first in a report from Axios. The stock market was down pretty strongly early in the morning and then immediately rebounded. So it's clear from Wall Street's perspective who they would rather have giving advice to the president.
Right. And what do you think then are some of Gary Cohn's priorities right now? There's so much tumult in the White House. He's got to be sensitive to how markets will be responding on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he's considered the White House's point man to sell their plan to cut taxes and reform the tax code. And as you mentioned, the press conference earlier this week, he was standing next to President Trump. Remember, that press conference was supposed to be about their infrastructure plans before it turned into a discussion of Charlottesville. So he's clearly at the center of taxes and infrastructure, which are two of the probably the most impactful, potentially, parts of the Trump platform as far as the economy goes.
That's Michael Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News, bringing us up to speed on the fact that Gary Cohn, White House economic advisor, is still staying with the president for now. Mike, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, and it comes on a day where we've got news that Steve Bannon, the White House chief strategist, is out. Sarah Huckabee Sanders, the White House press secretary, confirms that today is Bannon's last day. The Wisconsin State Assembly has passed a bill to give a $3 billion tax break to Foxconn. Republican Governor Scott Walker is trying to lure the Taiwanese electronics company to build an assembly plant in the state. They'd be making panels used in smartphones and televisions. President Trump has praised the plan and the company's leader, Terry Goh. Here's the president speaking at the White House last month.
The construction of this facility represents the return of LCD electronics and electronic manufacturing to the United States, the country that we love. That's where we want our jobs. To make such an incredible investment, Chairman Goh put his faith and confidence in the future of the American economy.
In recent years, though, Foxconn has been controversial for its poor record on workers' rights at its factory in China, where Apple's iPhones are assembled. In 2010, the factory made international headlines after several workers there committed suicide. Now, some Democratic lawmakers in Wisconsin are critical of the tax break deal with Foxconn. If approved by the state Senate, it would be the largest incentive package in Wisconsin's history. Joining us now with more is Marty Michelson, a reporter at WUWN in Milwaukee. Hi there, Marty.
Hi, Meghna.
All right. So a lot to talk about here. First of all, tell us more about the deal specifically. What does the state of Wisconsin get in exchange for giving Foxconn $3 billion in tax breaks?
Well, Foxconn of Taiwan wants to build a huge factory in southeastern Wisconsin. Under the deal, the state would give the company $3 billion in tax incentives and would relax some environmental rules in order to accommodate Foxconn. In exchange, Foxconn would invest $10 billion to build a 20 million square foot facility in Racine or Kenosha County. Now, these are two areas of the state that have lost a number of major manufacturers over the past few decades. Mm. Foxconn says the average salary would be $54,000 per year. The company would initially hire 3,000 people and could eventually employ up to 13,000 workers. And they would be assembling LCD flat screens.
So potentially a lot of jobs here. But yesterday, as the state assembly was voting on this, there were some emotional pleas for and against the deal. And perhaps it also wasn't along party lines, as I understand. So tell us more about that.
Yes, there were a number of impassioned pleas. Republican Governor Scott Walker, as well as Republicans who control the state legislature, have been pushing the deal, while Democrats have largely been opposed. Both sides delivered emotional pleas in the assembly on Thursday. Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, whose district is located in Racine County, called the deal a game changer.
Just imagine what a $10 billion investment is going to do for this area alone, much less for the entire state of Wisconsin. Imagine the new businesses that will open. Imagine the new restaurants, the new shops, the new careers that are going to be built.
But Democrats blasted the bill and pointed to fiscal estimates that show Wisconsin wouldn't begin to recoup the $3 billion in losses from the tax incentives until 2043. Democrat Gordon Hinds called it enormous corporate welfare.
How much Kool-Aid do you have to drink? Is it wise to force taxpayers to make a 15-year investment with a quarter-century payback under the best scenario on a highly automated plant in a global economy where technology is constantly changing?
But Marty, I understand that there were Democrats who had initially voiced their opposition to the deal, but some of them ultimately changed their minds and voted yes in favor of Foxconn and those tax incentives. Why did they do that?
All eyes were on three Democrats from the districts in which the company could be located. All three seemed to rail on the bill in the past few days, past few weeks. But in the end, those three Democrats said, although they have reservations about the bill, they had no choice but to vote yes because the area needs the jobs. Here's Racine Democrat Corey Mason.
It returns our community back to the dignity of work, of letting people know that they can do something with their own two hands and provide for their family with good middle-class jobs.
So where does it go from here, though? Because I understand that this isn't a done deal. So what's going to happen next?
You're right. It isn't a done deal yet. The bill did clear a major hurdle in passing the state assembly, but now it goes to the state Senate. Republican leaders in that chamber have indicated they might not have the votes yet for passage and are going to carefully consider the bill. There is a smaller Republican majority in the Senate, so sometimes this happens. The GOP needs to do a little more arm twisting to get the votes.
Well, Marty Michelson is a reporter for WUWM in Milwaukee, speaking to us about Wisconsin lawmakers moving forward on a $3 billion incentives package to bring Foxconn to the state. Marty, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, a website hosting company said this week that the Justice Department had served it with a warrant demanding that it hand over all files related to one of its customers' websites. But DreamHost is resisting turning over the documents, and legal experts say what happens in this case could have far-reaching consequences for First Amendment rights in the digital age. NPR's Laurel Wamsley reports.
In the weeks leading up to January 20th, the website disruptj20.org was a hub for coordinating protests against the inauguration of Donald Trump. Some of those protests in Washington, D.C. turned violent. Police officers were injured and property was damaged. Nearly 200 people now face felony riot charges. Last month, a D.C. judge granted the Justice Department a warrant for all of DreamHost's files related to Disrupt J20, including logs with information about people who simply visited the website.
What on earth could there be probable cause for that would justify turning over the logs of every single person who's ever looked at this site?
That's Mark Rumold, senior staff attorney at the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is advising DreamHost in its case.
There's no way that that's all evidence of a crime.
DreamHost called the move a clear abuse of government authority. Providers like DreamHost get requests all the time to provide law enforcement with information. And mostly we never hear about it because they quietly comply. Rumold says it's not unusual for investigators to get a warrant for IP logs and other digital records, but he says it's quite rare to ask for the logs of all visitors to a website.
From our perspective, it's always troubling when the government seizes far more information than it could ever use. I think what's particularly unique about this case is that the crime and the topic that is being investigated is a group of people who are politically opposed to the president.
DreamHost says it logs this information to prevent issues like attacks on one site bringing down all the others on the same server. One of the organizers of Disrupt J20, Legba Carrefour, says his group would never keep records on who comes to its website.
We don't want to know. We don't care. And also, I'm sure like half of those are probably cops.
Indeed, the government's affidavit says D.C. police used an undercover officer to attend one of the group's meetings in a D.C. church basement.
But the idea that the privacy of any single person who simply out of curiosity or because they're a part of the organizing or even if they were against us, having their then individual name disclosed to the FBI or the Justice Department, that's really frightening. Those people committed absolutely no crime. It is not illegal to go look at an anarchist website.
Paul Ohm is a former attorney at the Justice Department, and he's now a law professor at Georgetown University.
You could imagine that there might be hidden within the vast amount of data we're talking about some tiny tidbits that could be used in a criminal indictment or criminal case.
But Ohm says the government's warrant should be much narrower.
With a single warrant signed by a single judge, especially given the speech implications of this particular website, it's disturbing to me that that could be the single key that unlocks the political and speech habits of, I don't know how many people, might be thousands of people, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people.
He says this case isn't just about policing. It's also about First Amendment rights of speech and listening and petitioning the government.
Going forward in the future, if a FBI or Department of Justice wants to mimic this behavior and look at websites that are set up to plan protests, there should be some hesitation. There should be some ground rules, guardrails, so that this isn't a routine thing.
And those ground rules just might be written soon. D.C. Superior Court rescheduled the hearing in the matter it was supposed to hold today. Laurel Wamsley, NPR News.
And a note here. Last night, Tina Fey made a guest appearance on SNL's Weekend Update, introducing sheet caking when you bury emotions in cake. Then she dug into one and current events, closing with this about right-wing rallies this weekend.
I really want to say, to encourage all good, sane Americans to treat these rallies this weekend like the opening of a thoughtful movie with two female leads. Don't show up. Let these morons scream into the empty air. I love you, Charlottesville, and as Thomas Jefferson once said, who's that hot light-skinned girl over by the butter churn?
Tina Fey, everyone!
It's here now. The sounds of Big Ben, sounds that are going silent, at least for 4 years. The bell has announced the hour from Parliament's iconic clock tower in London since 1859, but Monday it will be stilled for at least 4 years for repair work on Parliament buildings. The BBC's Rich Preston joins us from just outside the tower. And Rich, tell us more about why Big Ben's going silent.
Well, Robin, this is part of major renovations at the British Houses of Parliament, a multi-billion dollar project. And an important part of that will be this famous clock tower. That includes cleaning and repairing damage to the clock itself, but also the tower it's housed within, the roof, the masonry, and elements of the internal structure, which all need critical repairs. And they're having to switch these bells off to protect the people who are going to be working so closely to it. And that's because Big Ben chimes at 120 decibels. That's like putting your ear next to a police siren. Now, the scaffolding is already halfway up. I can see it in front of me. The repairs have started, but as you said, the bells go silent on Monday. And this is costing £29 million. That's $37 million, just the renovations to this clock tower.
You know, most people can picture this huge clock face peeling since 1859. But just remind us more of its history.
Well, actually, let's start by saying that this famous clock tower isn't actually called Big Ben. It's called the Elizabeth Tower after Queen Elizabeth. It was renamed in 2012 for her Diamond Jubilee. Big Ben actually refers to the name of the bell inside the clock tower, and that chimed for the first time on July the 11th, 1859. And when it arrived at Parliament, it was a huge ceremony. It was brought down the River Thames on a barge, taken to Parliament on a carriage drawn by 16 white horses. So it's been chiming for more than 150 years through the reign of six monarchs, and it's a marker in Britain. You know, on December 31st, you guys look at the ball dropping at Times Square. We here in Britain, we look at Big Ben, and it's heard daily on BBC Radio, on our domestic Radio 4, our national news network. That marks the 6 o'clock news every single evening.
Did it fall silent for the war in wartime? When has it been silent before?
Well, it has been quietened on other occasions for 7 weeks in 2007, again for repairs, and between 1983 and 1985. And that was the last time there was major repair work done to the clock. Huh. And as you know, it's a major tourist attraction. It's said to be the most photographed landmark in the UK.
Well, and people aren't happy about it going silent. Cabinet Minister David Davis says it's mad to be for so long, 4 years. Conservative lawmaker James Grey says the decision is bonkers. You've said that it's to protect the people who are going to be working up there. But what are other people saying to you?
Yes, it is a contentious topic, and it has been talked about widely in the newspapers here. Several of them highly critical. The Daily Mail, for example, said, quote, not even Nazi bombs could silence the famous symbol of Britishness. And it blamed this silence on health and safety regulations. So I spoke to some people on Westminster Bridge taking their photos in front of this iconic clock.
I think it's beautiful. I don't know, I think it's amazing. I like it.
And on Monday, it's going to ring for the last time for 4 years. What do you think about that?
I don't think it's a happy thing, but if it has to be repaired, it's necessary.
It's the first time that I'm visiting here with this Big Ben, so next to the river. It's amazing. If you, when I'm watching that, it's like I'm riding in the history, you know, and it's amazing how they make it many years ago.
So you're lucky. You've come here, you will hear those bells ring.
Yeah.
But other people coming next year, the year after, they won't hear it ring. Yeah. Do you think that's sad for them?
Yes. It shows I'm a lucky girl.
It's our first time here in London. It's a beautiful. I didn't expect the gold. I thought in the pictures it doesn't do it justice.
When so I think of London, this is the main thing that you see.
With the repair works, mm-hmm. one of the things they're going to do is they're going to silence it for 4 years.
I'm happy we came today then. Yeah.
So those are some tourists here in London from Spain, Germany and Canada. Now, after all that criticism, Prime Minister Theresa May intervened. She said it can't be right that these bells are silenced until 2021. Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn said he would miss the sound of the bells, but to him, the most important issue is the welfare and safety of those working on it. He said it's not a national disaster or catastrophe and that we'll just have to work through it. But given all that criticism, the House of Commons now has said it will review the length of time needed for this construction work. That'll hopefully keep some lawmakers happy and also some of the many tourists who come to take their photos with Big Ben.
Rich Preston, the BBC, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.